Hello everyone, welcome to the Deep Psychology Podcast. I'm your host Ross Edwards and I'm really excited to be sharing with you this month my series called The Philosophy of Science. So this month the whole idea is to really dig into science, not from the point of view of learning equations and learning theories and so on, but looking at how do we know that science is true? What are the assumptions behind it? What are the philosophical critiques we can make of how science operates? And so on and so forth. And what this will do for you is it will really expand your mind and it will free you from scientific dogma. And to me, this is just absolutely crucial for your growth as a person and also your understanding and your ability not to just parrot other people, you know, the ability to think independently and to think critically, because science right now is, it has earned the right to be our main way of making sense of reality, essentially. You know, basically if something is approved by science, by and large we tend to accept it. And if it's not, by and large, we tend to reject it. So this is a double-edged sword, of course, because a lot of the time we don't really think about these things very carefully for ourselves. So that's the whole idea behind the series this month. I just want to say that each episode will be released, like all my other long-form episodes, every Wednesday at 8 p.m. UK time, 9 p.m. Central European time, 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I'm saying that because I've got listeners all over the world and I need to make sure that you all know when it's going to be. Make sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify to keep up with this series and my other series. I also want to say that apart from my long form Wednesday episodes, I have snippet episodes of those episodes, so like little 5 or 10 minute tasters every Thursday, Sunday and Tuesday at the same time that I mentioned there. And a quick mention at the moment that you can stay up to date with my latest episodes and projects via my newsletter. You can find a link to that in the description, and at the same link you will find my books as well if you want to go deeper with my work. So let's get into the topic of the philosophy of science. And I want to step out and do a little introduction to the month and all the themes we'll be covering, because there's so many things that will come up in our discussions here. And you'll be surprised just how broad they go. And I just want you to know where we're going. So first of all, the hidden assumptions within science. We're going to be looking at those. There are so many that we're not going to cover them all, but there are many assumptions made within science that are just assumptions, and some of them are really not true. Some of them are practically useful, but they're not actually true. We're going to look at the difference between assumption and proof, because of course, to assume something, you do so without really knowing whether it's true or not. We're going to look at the difference between philosophy and science. So, you know, we've spoken about this month, we're going to be doing the philosophy of science. So clearly there's a difference between philosophy and science, and what is that exactly? And how does that relate to everything we're talking about? We're going to talk about what science emphasizes. You know, in terms of what does science set out to do, what is its emphasis? And this might seem very obvious, but when you step out and realize, for example, that what it emphasizes is different from what philosophy emphasizes, you'll actually understand better what science is and what its limitations are. We're also going to look at the difference between models and explanations, because you can have a model of something. That doesn't mean it explains it, and it doesn't mean that it provides full proof that the thing actually works that way. It's just a model, you see. We're going to talk about how correlation is not causation, and this is one of the main things that bugs me about science, especially in sort of popular science, is that we assume that correlation is causation, and that is so obviously not true, and it's that science itself is very damning about this, but it doesn't often apply it to itself. It just assumes that a correlation is a causation. It's very sneaky. We're going to talk about our human biases for first causes, explanations, neat models, and hidden mechanisms. So our own need for clarity and for finality and closure when it comes to explanations for things is problematic, because of course that's what we're really doing with science. We're trying to explain things and then use those explanations to make practical innovation and so on. So if we have biases in that regard, well, they're going to filter in to science, of course. We're going to talk about the pressures on science, which most people don't think about. Things like financial pressures, the pressures of like the government and the health system, diagnostic pressures, you know, the pressure to give a diagnosis to someone, and the pressure of conformity. This is a huge one. And this is one of the main reasons we're doing this episode series, is to help free you of the conformity that occurs within science. Just like in any field or in any discipline, there's huge social pressure to go along with the accepted establishment science and to parrot it and to not question it too much. Even though science says it questions things, it doesn't really question things that deeply. We're going to talk about the dogmas of science, like scientism, physicalism, materialism, and pragmatism. And yes, I use the word dogma there quite confidently, because they are dogmas. They're not investigated really, and they're not questioned. They're just taken to be true. And that is really the definition of a dogma. We're going to talk about science as a tool versus science as a locked paradigm. Because in one sense, science, you can think of it as a tool. And when we call it a tool, we don't give it sort of philosophical, supremacy or primacy. But when we look at science more of as a paradigm, and we are locked into that paradigm, then all of a sudden it becomes primary. It becomes a way of actually explaining things in a kind of final way. We're going to talk about what is experience and why experience is primary, and this will help to loosen up a lot of the dogma that we find in science. We're going to talk about the relationship between biology, neurology, and experience, which will help you understand what experience is even more. We're going to talk about concept and reality, because as humans, we are highly conceptual creatures, and really all of science is conceptual. So if we don't realize that, we're in trouble. And finally, in episodes 4 and 5 of this month, because there's going to be 5 episodes, because there's 5 Wednesdays in April 2026, we're going to talk about my own model for all of this, and how all of these things, like epistemology, science, models, concepts, causality, and so on, link together. So what are our aims this month? Well, first of all, to make all these distinctions that we made above. So if you come to understand everything I've talked about there, you're going to have a much greater philosophical vocabulary. Now listen, I'm not pretending to be a philosopher. I'm going to talk about my background, but I have thought about these things a lot, and I feel like I'm a lot more open-minded than other mathematicians, scientists. And if you get come to understand this, you'll be in a lot better position than even a lot of professionals are. We're going to help free you from scientism, because scientism, in other words, believing that the scientific explanations are the sort of standard for truth, shall we say, this is preventing you from discovering the deepest aspects of reality, and from thinking carefully and independent yourself, because it's a dogma, and once you're locked inside a dogma, you cannot think. Now, of course, scientists will claim that they're not locked into scientism, and that scientism itself isn't a dogma, but that it simply isn't true. We're going to help you avoid treating science as absolutely true. I'm particularly interested in psychology and neurology, so we're going to look particularly at how the philosophy of science is important in psychology and neurology. So we're talking particularly about science applied to human beings and things like our psychology and spirituality and these things. And I also want to say that my aim isn't to throw away science. Of course, I recognise that science is a remarkable human invention, shall we say, and that it has transformed society forever. And of course, no matter how much I want to throw away science, if I did, it wouldn't happen anyway. So there's no point, even if I wanted that, to be sitting here advocating for it, because it's not going to happen. But my aim is philosophical and psychological, and it's about how we interpret and use science to make sense of ourselves and reality. And I think in that regard, we are really lacking, like quite extraordinarily lacking. So before we get into the main content of today's episode, I want to talk a bit about my own personal background, because you might be thinking, well, this is all very highfalutin and philosophical, Ross, but you know, how are you qualified to talk about this? Well, first of all, I have a STEM degree, so that's one thing. You know, I went through a very rigorous university course and got a very good STEM degree, and I spent, you know, 4 years studying pretty hardcore maths, and before that, I spent 6 years of high school studying maths, physics, chemistry to quite a high level. You know, at school, I studied to kind of the level that you would study at when you're in first year of university, because where I'm from, you have the option to do that in the final year of school. So I studied to a pretty high level in physics, chemistry, and maths, and at school, I'd got very, very high grades. So, you know, I've been through the sort of normal scientific education process. I've been through that for about 10 years. Now, granted, I didn't study physics or chemistry at university, but really it's past a certain point, it's all kind of the same. Not that, you know, studying maths doesn't mean you're a physicist, of course, but what I mean is that the thinking is all the same, and the kind of logic and the kind of the way that we draw conclusions and the way that we use the mathematical deductions and so on, you know, the way we apply the science is all really the same. And so yeah, I've had a pretty rigorous scientific upbringing or background. And also, on the other hand, but it's not, this isn't opposed, but it sounds opposed to from a scientific point of view, it can sound opposed. I've spent the last 10 years of my life meditating, studying philosophy, studying psychology, doing coaching, writing articles, doing this podcast, contemplating, going to retreats, doing psychedelics, studying epistemology, studying ontology. You know, I've gone into sort of the psychological, philosophical side of things, and I've become a bit of an original thinker. You can draw your own conclusions from my podcast episodes and my books, but you know, I'm getting to the point where I feel like the books I'm writing are pretty original. And yes, they are spiritual, very spiritual, but they are also very philosophical, and there's a lot of very careful philosophical thinking going on. And it's not just kind of the bullshit philosophy that you study in university, because I know what that's like. Studying René Descartes and goodness knows all the usual philosophers that you get. It's not that. It's very applied and it's very experiential, but it's, I would call it careful thinking and careful deduction about what we can know. That is philosophy. It's just more applied and it's more original than your bullshit academic philosophy. So I feel like I've got a good grasp from both. You know, I've done a bit of both here. You know, I've done a lot of scientific experiments and I've done mathematical studies at a very high level. But I've also done a lot of things that standard scientists will never do in their entire lives. You know, how many scientists go on meditation retreats, for example? Like, very few. So that gives me, you know, I'm not a professional scientist. I'm more of a professional writer and a professional thinker and teacher more than anything else. But, you know, I've got a very good balance, I think. And what I can tell you, and this is where we're starting to kind of transition into the main content for today's episode, after setting up this series, the actual main content of today's episode is about scientific dogma and unexamined assumptions that are made in science. And I can tell you right now, from my experience, that scientific education emphasizes certain things very strongly and it doesn't emphasize other things. Now, that's very obvious. You know, it's so obvious that you might just overlook it, but that itself is problematic, because then as soon as you realize that, you must ask, well, what does it emphasize, and does it correctly emphasize those things, or does it emphasize the correct things, and what does it miss out? And it's obviously going to miss something out, because it has to draw, you know, if you're going to educate people in science, you have to draw a line somewhere. You can't just start educating them about everything, because there's no time and there's no you know, for so many reasons. So it's like, to define what we're going to teach people, you have to draw a line around certain things and then exclude everything else. So what are those things? And then how does that feed into how it's taught? Well, listen, first of all, and this is just, it's so fucking obvious, but you don't realize it when you're studying it. And I didn't realize it until about my last year. And I'll explain why. Anyways, I'll tell you what it is. Science education emphasizes rote learning. So, you know, you might have this idea, if you've never done, I'll call it STEM, because it's all scientific, and I'd really, you know, my main experience is in maths and statistics. So in STEM education, you are rote learning. There's very little, like, original thinking going on. You're basically just studying what is already quote-unquote known in the field. And you're not really taught to question it. You're not taught to think originally about it. And you're just kind of implicitly taught that it's correct. You know, you'll study a certain, let's say, a certain area of statistics, and then you'll study, like, certain statistical models, and they'll have a name, and you know, the whole way it's framed is like, here's a model and we know it's right and you've just got to study it and remember it. You know, that's rote learning. And you're not, of course, you use the models and you do calculations with them and you kind of learn how to apply them, yes, but it's still very rote learning. Like, you're taught how to do it all. You're not really taught to sit down and think about it and think how to apply it yourself. And you know, even start to question and ask, well, how can we, is this even applicable? Is this right? Is this, what are the limitations of this model? Where does it break down in the real world? Now, I'm not saying that professors need to sit and do all that, but they don't even like encourage you. Like, I'm not saying that necessarily you would be sitting in a lecture to, you know, taking apart a model, because there's only so much time, but it's like they don't even encourage you. Like, they don't, it's like the whole attitude is, here it is, learn it, it's correct, learn it, you're ignorant, you should be learning this, right? And it never really improves throughout the whole of university. The only real point I think you'd probably not be doing that is when you're doing a dissertation or you're doing like a master's project or you're doing a PhD. But even then, because science is so fucking dogmatic, like, it's still, there's still an element of rote learning in it. Like, you're gonna, if you're doing like a dissertation, for example, you're gonna, you know, you're gonna have like 20 sources or something that you're using, and you're not questioning any of them. You're essentially doing rote learning. Now, you might not be sitting in a lecture theater learning it, or sitting, you might not be sitting memorizing everything from that source, but you, that's not the point. It's the fact that there's no real filter. You just kind of accept it to be true. Now, there might be exceptions. There might be people who don't do that. But that's not the point. It's the fact that that's how the whole education is set up. It's set up so that you basically believe in what you're being taught. It's biased towards calculation, modeling, and prediction. So, you know, let's say you're studying physics, and as I said, I did do this in school for 6 years and to a pretty high level, to university equivalent. So I know what I'm saying here. Let's say you learn, I don't know, some equation about magnetism or something. The basic approach is you learn the formula. You might do some experiments to kind of semi-derive the formula, although past a certain point, that's really difficult without having like advanced mathematics. It's quite difficult. Then you're taught, how do you calculate with it? So you're sort of taught, like, here's how you can manipulate it. Let's pick some numbers, let's put them in, let's make up some sort of artificial examples for you to use, and then let's see if you can calculate, you know, the final value and all the rest of it. And then you'll get your 4 out of 4, whatever marks it is. And so it's biased towards calculation, it's biased towards modeling, you know, it's like, how can we use this equation to model like a physical situation, or how can we use it to calculate the magnetic field of a certain planet or whatever. And it's used towards prediction as well. What's the theme binding it all? It's the calculation component. It's the component of using the equation to calculate numbers, right? So you might ask, well, what's the problem with that? The problem with that is that it's, you're just seeing the final result. Like, you're not really being taught to derive the thing from first principles, as though you yourself were deriving the equation, or even like contemplating these problems. You're not really asking, you know, where does this apply? Like, and should we, is it right that we should apply a scientific equation in this case? You know, it's like the mechanical. It's a bit like learning how to fix an engine without let me explain it better. It's like learning how to drive a car without understanding how the engine works. That's exactly what you're doing when you're memorizing equations and learning how to calculate with them. You don't know where the equation came from. I mean, some people do. Most people don't know and they don't care. And the professors don't bother explaining it. So you're learning, all right, I have this equation. I know roughly where I can apply it. Even though in real life, I don't have a fucking clue where I can apply it because we don't talk about that. And, you know, you know how to plug it in and get the right answer, but you don't have any clue of what's going on behind all of that. Not really. And that is one of the that's one of the reasons why a lot of scientists are not actually very good philosophical thinkers, because they weren't taught to do that. They weren't taught to really look at what they are doing and why they are doing it. They're simply mechanically driving the car without understanding how the car works and what the limitations are of the machinery and so on, without wanting to stretch the metaphor too much. Science education emphasizes believing in science. Like, I'm being very literal here. Like, I'm not saying they like threaten you with, you know, going to hell and being excommunicated if you don't believe in science. But you know, when you're studying all of this, when you're studying physics and chemistry and mathematics and so on, subtly, you're being taught that it is all right. Because why would you be studying an equation if they didn't think it was right? Why would you be taught physics if they didn't think it was right? Why would you be getting examined on it? Like, the whole approach is that this is right and you need to learn it. And it's like, why? Like, why to learn science, why do you need to believe it's right? Why? You know, I could do as well in an exam as now. Let me go on a bit of a tangent. Right now, I believe science is right in its own context, but to say it's correct as like a metaphysical claim, I'm very reluctant to say that. But would that stop me doing well in a science exam? Probably not, because I'm capable and I've demonstrated to myself over the years that I can learn these things. But at university or at school, they don't realize the difference between being able to understand and use science versus believing in it. And the three just get smudged together. So that when you, like, for example, I don't know if you have any family or friends that have studied a scientific degree of any kind, a STEM degree, but I can almost guarantee you that they believe in science. Like, they believe it's right, and they have studied it so much that they have confused studying it and understanding the sort of concepts of it with believing in it. And this is the case for many reasons, but it's partly just because you are taught to believe in it and you are kind of, you know, you're not taught to distance from it and you're not taught to, what's the word, take it lightly while still being able to study it, you see? So it's like, they're all smudged together. And I just kind of, the way I look at it now is just like, why? Like, why do you need to believe in science and everything that you're taught in order to be able to study it? Like, those things are not the same. You can, you know, there are many things that you could study without having to necessarily believe that they are true. Like, you could study the origins of Christianity and think that it's all nonsense, but you could study it as like an interesting thing, but you're not taught to do that. You're taught to, again, this happens very implicitly, and it's not like it would happen in church, although I'd be reluctant to say it happens very explicitly in church as well, but it's all happening under the surface, but now I'd be very aware that it's happening. It's just implicit in the way it's taught. It's like, here's an equation, it's right, you study it, and you've got it. That's it, you're done. I'll also say that, and this is going to be, you know, a lot of people like to tell me I'm direct, like family and friends and stuff, and this will be an example of me being very direct. But I say it to myself, because I have taught maths, not in like school or a university, but as a like a bit of my own self-employed business, I've taught maths, and I know how it goes. Most teachers and lecturers are simply parrots. They're parrots. They hear something and they just repeat it. They hear something, they just believe it. They don't filter it. They just accept it, and it becomes part of their scientific knowledge database. Like, I know that might sound like an insult, but it's just, it's a fact. It's not even an insult, because that's just like the status quo. That's just like what the education system produces. That's what the PhD system produces. It doesn't produce people who think carefully about these things and think carefully about the limits of science. It creates parrots. That's what it does. It's like, you know, if you're trained to become a priest, that's what would happen. You would train to defend Christianity at all costs. This is what happens with science. Teachers and lecturers, they love the models and the theory, and they love their discipline, and they just assume that it's all true. Like, there is no distance from it. It's like there's an identification. And it's like, it's almost like innocently cute. You know, it's just like, this equation, this proof, this is what we do with it. This is how you can work with it. End of story. Like, that's not questioning. That's not really wisdom. And that's not true knowledge. That's just being a parrot, you see. It's very much like learning a religious text. You know, it's just, here it is, this is what it is, take it in and move on. And the teachers, you know, if you ask like your maths teacher or your maths lecturer, why is this true? And you really, like, you started to get into like the depths of mathematics with them, they would start to close down. They wouldn't be curious about it with you. They would start to close down. And that's because they're a parrot and they don't actually know what they're talking about. Now, listen, I've come across exceptions. I have. I've come across, well, very few, to be honest. Like, not that many. But I have come across some decent examples of people who aren't like this. But mostly not, like, seriously. Like, very few exceptions. You see, again, why, as a maths or physics or whatever teacher or lecturer, why do you need to believe it's true? You know, why? Is it, if you really ask that question, you'll realize it's just an identity thing. It's just because you really need it to be true. You really need to believe in it so firmly, because it gives you your identity, right? And very little attention, you know, so I've talked a bit about what scientific education emphasizes. What does it not emphasize? And the way I look at it is that these things are great limitations, or they're great pieces that are missing from the puzzle. Very little attention is given to epistemology. Epistemology just means the study of knowledge, the study of how do we know things. Very little attention is given to epistemology. Like, I don't think I even knew what that word meant when I was at university, which is quite ironic, because if you're going to know what that means, it's probably when you're doing like intense academic study. But again, because I studied a STEM degree and there's no fucking philosophical study at all, well, you're not going to learn what epistemology is, much less actually study it and, hell, contemplate these things for yourself. Very little attention is given to the philosophy of science, which is exactly what we're talking about today and this month. You know, the study of how do we derive truth from science. That is not talked about. What is talked about how can we apply it, right? But that is not the same as how do we derive truth from science. If you don't understand that distinction, we're going to talk about that more this month, so don't worry. Very little attention is given to the limits of explanation. So, models and concepts and explanations are just fused with truth. They're seen as equivalent. And people don't realize that, or very little attention is given to studying the limits of explanation. And also very little attention is given to is given to open-mindedness and skepticism. And you might think, well, science is very skeptical. It's skeptical of what it wants to be skeptical of, but it's not very skeptical of itself. You know, the scientific people like to say that they're skeptical, but they're not skeptical of science itself, and they're not skeptical of their own attachment to science. And also, science is supposed to be founded on skepticism, but again, it's not. And science is like, God, I feel like this is a kind of tangent, but science is like an organism trying to protect itself. And it will proclaim that it's open-minded and all of that. But if it feels threatened, it will bark at you and it will chase after you. That's exactly what science does. And because of all this, scientists are usually very poor philosophers because they're not interested in philosophy. They see it as abstract nonsense. And I think what's going on really underneath is that they're actually a bit scared of philosophy because they probably realise that they've never really sat down and thought about their science. And so philosophy could have damaging implications for their work. So we've really set up this month's series and today's episode. So let's get into like the main content of today, which is scientific dogma, unexamined philosophical assumptions within science, of which there are many. And really, what happens is that these assumptions, even though an assumption is simply something that you are proposing to be true, as a starting point, these are treated as facts and then passed on to the point that assumptions within science actually go unnoticed because they are baked into the entire sort of, you know, all the theories you learn and all the facts that you learn and all of this. It's baked in to the point that you can't actually see the assumption, especially when you're a student and you haven't thought about these things very carefully. The assumption goes unnoticed, which is like the worst kind of assumption. You know, you could, if you had a list of assumptions on the sign on your, on, you know, the wall in your lecture theatre, on your, in your classroom, that told you, here are the philosophical assumptions we're making here, then it'd be better, because at least you would realize that they're assumptions. But that does not happen. At least it certainly didn't happen to me, and I don't think it does happen at all. So assumptions like this are essentially dogma because they're accepted to be true without questioning, and you never question it. You don't question it at all. So we'll focus on the world of neuroscience because that's kind of what we'll be talking about most this month. But you will see things, you know, bits and bobs from other areas in science coming in. And really, the conclusions I'm making here, the sort of comments I'm making here, it applies to all of science. It's not just neuroscience. It's just that the examples are very good for neuroscience, and it's particularly relevant for psychology and spirituality. So, the idea of measurement. So, in neuroscience, for example, if you want to understand things about the body and the brain, and even the mind, the assumption is, well, let's get the machinery out, you know, and let's get those electrodes on, and let's start doing things to you and see how you react. And we're going to measure it, and we're going to do calculations based on that. So, you know, on one hand, we can say, well, it seems like an obvious thing to do. And of course, without this, where would neuroscience be without this? Where would science be without this? But you have to wonder, is measuring people with machinery the only way to find out what is true about the human mind, the human brain, the nervous system, our psychology and so on? Is this the best way? Is it the only way? Is it the right way? You see, we just assume that that is the way. What if it's not? What if there's 100 other ways that we haven't even thought of yet? And you might be surprised, you know, you might think that sounds very far out there. It's like, oh, Ross, well, that's, you know, that sounds very revolutionary. But that's, human life is fucking revolutionary. Imagine going back to the Middle Ages before we had electricity and you saying to someone, you know, there's the guy that's lighting all the gas lamps in the street when the sun's going down, and you say to him, what if there's a different way to do this? You know, what if, for example, sir, if we could generate something called electricity at will and we could spread it around the entire country, and this would enable us to light electric bulbs, and you wouldn't be needing to be filling them up all the time, and you wouldn't need to be lighting them up all the time, and you know, it would be much more efficient. We could literally turn it off and off with a switch at the wall. You see, that whole thing would just be completely beyond the pale. And it's not just because they didn't have the technology. It's literally because it was inconceivable at the time. And this might just be happening with our obsession with measurement and with, you know, calculation and so on. This might just be our version of the oil lamp. You know, it might just be a means to an end. And listen, it probably will, because though there's certain things in science that stick around forever, a lot of it gets completely replaced. And a lot of it just gets debunked, quite honestly. And it's like, this is the kind of open-mindedness you need. Like, if you think measurement is the only way, well, how do you know? Like, that is a, it's not a self-fulfilling prophecy. What is it? It's kind of like, as soon as you believe that, you lock yourself in. You know, you say measurement is the only way, by definition, you're not going to think that maybe there's another way. And you're locked into that, and that locks you into the scientific paradigm. Another assumption that we make, which is really to say another piece of dogma, is that neurons create experience. This is implicitly behind all of neuroscience, really. For example, right, if you ask a neuroscientist, how is it that we are aware? They're going to go to neurons. Like, if you wanted to summarize their answer, it would just be neurons or neural activity. That's literally what it would be. It would be that you're aware because of the neurons in your brain. But have they ever actually thought about that? Like, we don't know. You know, let's say that that's true, that neurons create. I'm using the word create very carefully, and we'll talk about this later on, why the word create is the word I'm using. I'm not saying it's the correct word. I'm just saying it's the word I'm using to describe the way things are seen in the scientific world. If you say neurons create our experience, you have to realize that we actually don't know how that happens. And this is a classic problem in science, that they don't know how consciousness is created, awareness is created, which is just to say, how is it you can have this subjective sense of experiencing the world based on like a physical substrate, like your brain? Now listen, without spoiling the party, because this is a question we're going to answer this month, slowly and surely, basically I don't believe in that at all. That's all I'll say. I don't believe that neurons create experience. But you see, this is just a dogma. This is just accepted. And this is how we talk about the human body and human psychology and the human mind. We always put it back to fucking neurons. But explain how that works. Like, if you believe that, explain it to me. How does that work? And like, when I ask you really fundamental philosophical questions about how that works, don't just fucking avoid them. Explain. I have never seen a convincing explanation of how that works. And that's because scientists are not good philosophers and they don't care. They care about they care about it being measurable, calculable, modelable, manipulable in all of this. It doesn't really matter about the philosophical understanding of it. Another assumption is that concept equals reality. Let me give you a very simple example. The word neuron. What is the word neuron? Is the word neuron a neuron? No. The word neuron is not a fucking neuron. The word neuron is a word, right? The word neuron is a word. It's just a sound that I'm using, right? So scientists don't realize even something like this, that the word neuron is not a neuron. They don't understand that the model of how a neuron works is not how a neuron actually works. It's a model. They don't realize that we don't actually see neurons ever. No one has ever seen a neuron. Well, listen, unless there's like some crazy powerful microscope in some area of the world that I don't know about. I'm pretty sure we've never seen neurons. Like, no one has ever actually seen a neuron. We've seen the, you know, we've inferred it and we've modeled it and we've diagrammed them and we've measured them indirectly, right? That's not seeing a neuron. So what am I getting at here? We have never actually, you know, all we have of neurons is the word neuron. We have models and we have our, what's the word? We have our derived knowledge of neurons and we have measurements. We don't have neurons themselves. You see, we don't actually understand neurons because we're in our, and this is not just about neurons. It's not about the fact that they're microscopic, although of course that is a big influence. It's literally the fact that the human mind is a concept machine. And when it's, when we're so thickly lost in concepts, like science is, it doesn't realize, or we don't realize, that concepts and reality are two different things. Look at your device that you're listening to this right now. What is that device? Immediately you'll tell me, oh, it's a computer, Ross, or it's a mobile phone, Ross, or it's, what else could you be listening on? A speaker. But that's not what it is. The device is what it is before you call it anything. You see, that's how conceptual we are. We even confuse our names of things for the thing themselves. Scientists don't realize this. And imagine how problematic this is. A name is one thing. A name is not a huge deal, and we need names. But imagine not realizing this when your whole system is conceptual, and especially when we're talking about microscopic things like neurons, which we don't actually understand directly, only indirectly. This one right here, this following one, is huge, and I'm going to do an entire episode on it, and I'm really tempted to like talk about this for so long, so I'm going to have to hold myself back. Right, this is huge. Correlation mistaken for causality. Correlation mistaken for causality. This is an enormous mistake that's made within science. So for example, let me give you a really good example of this, right? Related to neurons and shit. Right. Here's an example of correlation. Brain circuits activate when fear is present. You know, for example, the amygdala is very active, apparently, when we experience fear. Right, so if I say brain circuits are active when fear is present, that is a correlation claim, because you're saying that something happens alongside something else, right? It accompanies it. A causation statement would be something like, brain circuits cause fear to be present, cause us to experience fear. So, because you're saying, just let me elaborate, you're saying those circuits are the reason why, and the only reason. You know, if those circuits weren't active, you wouldn't experience fear. And the only reason why you experience fear is because of those circuits, right? So, what happens in science, especially things like neuroscience and applied sciences, is correlation is mistaken for causation. So in this case, a scientist will read the statement, brain circuits activate when fear is present, and they will immediately convert it into a causation statement. They will immediately interpret that to mean that brain circuits cause fear to occur. But why does that need to be the explanation? How can your brain cause fear? Like, what? How can a squidgy lump of flesh cause fear? And you might say, well, it's not just a squidgy lump of flesh, Ross. It's the most complex squidgy lump of flesh in the universe, apparently. Right, fine. But so? How can a squidgy lump of flesh cause fear? How can neurons cause you to experience fear? You see, listen to the language very, very carefully. Cause. As though neurons were the and the only cause. The one and only cause of your fear was your neurons. You see, this is where science really starts to fall off a cliff, as far as I'm concerned. When it comes to like the philosophical understanding of science, this is basic errors like this, like correlation and causation. This is such a huge error. And again, I'm not going to go any further with this because I could speak about this for ages and I'm going to do an entire episode on it. But just know, correlation and causation can coexist, but often correlation and causation are two different things. And often we mistake one for the other because we see one thing to cause another when actually we don't have any evidence that that's the case. On a similar note, we assume that the brain is responsible for things. You know, this is how neuroscience tends to work. They try and study how the brain works in certain situations, and then they claim that the brain is responsible for whatever they're measuring. Like, let's say, attention span, for example. Well, that comes down to the brain at the end of the day, right? Because it's, you know, in your prefrontal cortex, I believe, you know, that's where your attention circuits are housed. So ultimately, if you've got some sort of ADHD, well, it's a brain thing. It's to do with your prefrontal cortex. Or I do apologize if that's not actually the right area of the brain, but I don't have an amazing knowledge of the brain areas. But I'm just saying, like, it doesn't matter. We assume that the brain is responsible for things, which is basically the same as saying it is the one and only cause of things. But again, have you ever actually sat down and thought about what it means to say that? Neuroscientists probably haven't, and most people don't sit and think about this. Another assumption: there is a self. There is a self. So it's an interesting one. And this is a huge problem within science in general, is scientists often haven't done any spiritual work. And they simply believe that the self is a physical thing with a physical location, because that's the default human experience. So if you've not done spiritual work, it's unlikely you're going to realize that that's not the case. And you might ask, well, so what? Well, the thing is that the scientist is the one doing the science, apparently. So if they misunderstand the self, they're going to misunderstand everything that they're doing. And especially with something like neuroscience, where we're sort of studying the mechanisms of the self and the psychology and the mind and so on, right? But if we don't realize that the self is not a solid thing that you can locate anywhere, that changes the entire interpretation of everything that neuroscience is talking about. And if you ask, listen, it's interesting, because if you asked a neuroscientist, what is the self? They would probably go straight to a neuroscientific point of view. And the neuroscientific point of view would basically say that it's brain activity. So what does that mean? They themselves are basically saying that the self doesn't exist as an actual thing. They're saying that it's simply the result of brain activity, which in other words is to say that it's like a series of patterns. However, I would challenge you to meet a single neuroscientist that lives life with actual recognition of what the self is. Because you see, they're so lost in concepts that they don't realize that their own fucking neuroscience contradicts the idea of a self. Because it itself, even in its own flawed paradigm, would say something like, well, the self is just a result of brain activity. It's not actually a thing. But then ask the neuroscientist and, you know, talk to them and you'll realize that they don't, there's no embodiment of that whatsoever because they don't realize the depth of it because they're not engaged in spiritual work. You see, so what one thing you'll notice in science is a lot of, you know, scientists talk about all sorts of weird shit about the universe and, you know, a quantum physicist will be able to tell you that, oh, the world, like the world around you is 99.99999% empty space and all the rest of it. When you actually look at how they live their life, they don't live their life as though these things are true. They just live like everyone else because there's an enormous difference between understanding something and regurgitating knowledge and actually embodying it, right? And it goes for the self. Let's go further into that because knowledge is confused with wisdom in science. In other words, when knowledge, wisdom is just basically seen as an accumulation of factual knowledge in like a from the scientific point of view. That is literally what wisdom is. You know, but as far as I'm concerned, that is not wisdom. That's simply conceptual. It's not direct. You've not really discovered anything for yourself. It's indirect. It's indirect. As soon as you use a label for something, it's indirect, right? And as soon as you have no direct experience of it, it's indirect. And that is not wisdom, you see? For example, right? Instead of doing science, what you could do is go do meditation for 10 years, do psychedelics, do a lot of contemplation, go and get some direct spiritual insight, and that will eventually tell you that there is no fixed self. You cannot find yourself as a permanent thing. It will eventually tell you there's nothing outside your direct experience. There's nothing outside your experience. Now that is insight and that is wisdom and that is embodied. That is wisdom because it's a discovery that you have made through yourself, through your own process. Scientific knowledge is not wisdom in and of itself. It's wisdom when it becomes fully understood and fully applied and fully kind of grasped. But that, how often does that actually happen in science? Not very much. And scientists don't understand it. They just mistake accumulation of knowledge for wisdom, which is why we all like to parrot scientific knowledge, because it makes us seem smart or wise. And you know, it's better than not knowing it, I suppose, or it can be, but it's not the same as wisdom. Wisdom is an earned thing, and it's something that you earn through your own faculties, your own questioning, your own discovery, your own experience. Scientific knowledge is not wisdom in and of itself. And finally, we're going to talk about how science assumes that experience occurs in the brain. Now again, this is another one that this is going to form like a huge part of my next episode. So I'm going to try to hold myself back here. But basically, science, I've literally heard this, that your experience occurs in the brain. When I say experience, I mean like your thoughts, your emotions, your perceptions, your vision, your sight, your sound. People literally say things like this, that this stuff occurs in the brain. This is just, it's ridiculous. Like, how can that occur in the brain? Inside the brain? Like, literally inside the brain, this stuff occurs. No, it doesn't. Your experience occurs in your experience. That's the only place it occurs. Your experience doesn't happen inside your brain. Like, if I come along and I cut your skull open, I look inside your brain, I'm not going to see anything. I'm not going to see your subjective experience. I'm going to see a lump of flesh and weird, weird brain tissue. That is just, like, it's the most fucking absurd thing. How, like, oh my, I don't even, it's like, it's so ridiculous. In fact, it's so ridiculous that it's actually the opposite. The opposite is true. Your brain occurs within experience, because your experience is everything. Spiritual insight, direct spiritual insight will show you that you cannot get outside of your experience. So your brain is inside experience. Your experience is not happening inside your brain. It's happening, your experience is happening your brain is happening inside experience. And I would ask you, well, if all your experience is happening inside your brain, where is your brain? Because if you say, well, my brain is inside my body, but the only reason you know your body is through your experience. So you're saying your brain happens, your experience happens inside your brain, which is inside your body, but where's your fucking body? Right? The only reason you know your body is because you experience your body. So where's your body exactly? You see that, like, it's... Oh, I wish I could, like, explain why this is such a ridiculous thing to assume. And in fact, the only reason you know that a brain exists is because you've seen pictures and videos of brains. Or maybe in biology class, you've, like, dissected a frog brain or something. You have never seen your own brain. I mean, some people, for some weird reason, might have seen their own brain. But I certainly haven't. I don't know anyone that's seen their own brain. You have never seen your own brain. Like, let that sink in. Of everything you've experienced in your entire life, you have never experienced this thing that apparently is responsible for everything. How do you even know your brain exists? Like, I'm being very literal. I'm also kind of exaggerating, because we can be pretty sure that our brain exists, and I wouldn't want to try and find out if it really does. Like, I wouldn't really want to see my brain. That's kind of gruesome. But, like, you see the problem with knowledge. Like, it's all stacked upon so many assumptions, but you've never even seen your own fucking brain. And no neuroscientist has seen their own brain. You see the problem? And you might say, well, okay, Ross, experience doesn't happen inside your brain, but your brain renders your experience. Okay, so you're basically saying that the brain is kind of like, I don't know how to describe it. It's sort of the empty canvas upon which your experience occurs, and you're just experiencing this sort of projection on the canvas. That's how I'd understand that argument. But again, how do you know that? Have you ever actually seen that happening? And again, if that's true, where is your brain? Where is your brain occurring? Is your brain just another experience? Because again, you only know your brain because of your experience. So if you imagine a brain, where is that brain? You know, you have this image of your brain being, your experience being rendered by the brain, but when you picture that, where is it occurring? That's occurring within your experience. So you see the problem. It's like our experience is all-encompassing. So saying that it's rendered by the brain, which is something that we only ever experience, is very circular and problematic. And I might say to you, well, what renders the brain? Like, if you're so stuck on the idea of rendering, what renders the brain? Where does the brain actually exist? Like, what is the... And you say, well, the brain is physical. Right, but so the entire world is physical. So why does that mean that the brain is rendering it? So, well, I should say, under your paradigm, the world is physical. I don't believe that the world is physical in an absolute sense. But you see that I don't claim to have like answers to all these things. I'm just like trying to show you that it's a very tr this is it's very tricky. Like, if you start asking these questions, you realize there are no simple answers. I'm not saying the answers don't exist. I'm just saying that there are no simple answers. And science cannot give them these answers. Scientific models are powerful tools for things, but a model is not the same as an ontological and philosophical explanation. Like, saying that your brain renders experience, it might be a useful model, but if you actually dig into the philo if you dig a little bit into it and you ask some philosophical questions, you realize that it doesn't actually make a lot of sense. And ultimately, I'm not giving you, like, this month I will give you answers, I will, but it's not, I'm not sitting here, the whole idea is not to give you answers, it's so that you ask questions, because science doesn't get you to ask questions, it gets you to jump to conclusions about a lot of things that are simply mysterious and that we simply do not know, that scientists themselves don't know, but they just assume because they can't sit with they can't sit with the tension of not knowing and admitting that they actually don't know. And though science can give us a lot of information, when we are not very careful philosophically, we start misinterpreting it. And as we'll talk about later this month, this actually has like some very real effects, not only on science, but on our lives and on our psychology, on what we believe is possible, on what we think life is, on what we think we are, other people, the world. This affects our entire perception, our entire experience of life. All right, everyone, I think I'm done for episode one in this series on the philosophy of science. I really hope you enjoyed that and it's got you thinking. Make sure to subscribe to me on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. I have new long form episodes every Wednesday at 9 p.m. Central European Time, 8 p.m. UK time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, and snippets on Thursday, Sunday, and Tuesday, 5 or 10 minutes of the long form episode just for a little taste of it. And of course, you can stay up to date with my latest episodes and projects via my newsletter. There's a link in the description that in for that, and you'll find my books there as well. I also want to say that you can also find my podcast categories in the description. You'll notice that in the description there's a link to my podcast categories, and what this basically is I've organized my 200 plus episode archive into categories so that you're not just wading through 200 episodes to find what you want to listen to. If you click on that link, you'll be taken to a section on the homepage of my website where all the categories are there. If you click the arrow, a player will open for that category, and so you can sit and listen to that category and look through it and find, it's a much easier way of navigating the archive. All right, everyone, thanks a lot for tuning in. I'll be back with my snippet episodes during the week, and then next Wednesday for my second episode in this series on the philosophy of science. And you might like to check out my philosophy category of episodes in the meantime. Take care, and I'll see you very soon.